really do hope that we can preserve like the original like characteristics of Bitcoin. There can be compromises, like even with Lightning today. It's of course a different threat model. It's a different like trust model. But if there are multiple layer twos or then layer three, four, whatever, you can choose the one that is best suited for you. And I think if we take care to build good stuff, like in an honest, transparent way, and this is also why open source is so incredibly important, then we can build a new financial system that actually scales without compromising on the core values.
Greetings and salutations, my fellow plebs. My name is Walker, and this is the Bitcoin Podcast. The Bitcoin time chain is 858659, and the value of one Bitcoin is still one Bitcoin. Today's episode is Bitcoin Talk, where I talk with my guest about Bitcoin and whatever else comes up. Today, that guest is Staticus. Staticus is an IT engineer and the product lead at Bitbox. We cover a range of topics today around Bitcoin self-custody, including the risk of keeping your Bitcoin on exchanges, the benefits of hardware wallets like Bitbox, the importance of backups with microSD cards and paper, and multi-sig setups for larger sums. We also dig into the pros and cons of different hardware wallets, stateless devices, DIY versus managed multi-sig, guns, Switzerland, Bitcoin scaling, the importance of open source software development, the dark Skippy attack and how Bitbox protects against it, and the impact of regulations on Bitcoin, plus a whole lot more. I think you're going to love this episode, and I guarantee you will learn a lot too. Before we dive in, do me a favor and subscribe to the Bitcoin Podcast wherever you're watching or listening, and check out my sponsor, Bitbox, in the show notes, or go directly to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker for 5% off the fully open source, Bitcoin-only Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. You can also grab links to protect yourself from SIM swap attacks using Ifani and Cloaked Wireless. I am a one-man show, so when you use my partner links, it genuinely helps me keep this show running, and I really appreciate it. If you'd rather watch this show than listen, head to the show notes for links to watch on YouTube, Rumble, and now on Noster via Highlighter. But if you're like me and you prefer to just listen to your podcasts, I highly recommend you check out Fountain.fm. Not only can you send Bitcoin to your favorite podcasters, but you can earn Bitcoin just for listening to this show. And they now have a Noster integration, which is pretty fucking cool. Finally, if you are a Bitcoin-only company interested in sponsoring another fucking Bitcoin podcast, hit me up on social media or through the website bitcoinpodcast.net or shoot me an email. It's hello@bitcoinpodcast.net. Without further ado, let's get into this Bitcoin talk with Staticus. Staticus, welcome to another fucking Bitcoin podcast. It is great to have you on here.
My pleasure.
You know, it's always fun to talk about hardware and to talk about security. And I say it's fun, but granted, a lot of people coming into Bitcoin, I think it's one of the things that is perhaps the biggest kind of scary moment for them when they're starting out their Bitcoin journey is, okay, I've gone down this rabbit hole a little bit. I've got some Bitcoin. And now I feel like I need to do something more of it. I need to actually take it into my own self-custody, but that means I am now responsible for it. And that can be scary for people. In the fiat world, we're not used to this, right? But I want to kind of talk to you about that journey today. But maybe before we dive in, can you just tell, for those who don't know you, who are you? How did you get here today to be open source everything, hardware, building? What was your journey?
So I'm an IT engineer on the older side. So I'm not quite a boomer, but in our team, I'm definitely the senior guy, not in terms of experience, but in terms of gray hair. I'm coming from like some big companies. I've been working quite a while with Accenture, then at PwC. So I'm familiar with big corporations, like consulting, stuff like that. But at heart, I'm a tinkerer. This is also why I started the Raspi Bolt project, which was one of the first Raspberry Pi Lightning full node projects. It's not something you can download. It's just a guide, but it has grown like a lot. And basically, it's a journey. So it's less about the end result, but to learn and grow and do everything yourself. And of course, it's open source because it's just like it lives from all the different contributors. I'm no longer really in the lead there. It became a community project a long time ago. But it's still my own go-to guide if I need to look up something, if I do know like Linux command line and stuff like that. Yeah, and I started at Bitbox like 5 or 6 years ago, actually for this purpose, building the Bitbox base, we called it back then. It's like a fully commercial, nicely produced full node. That was before there were powerful Raspberry Pis, so you couldn't actually sync the blockchain on a Raspberry Pi back then. There were no open source free projects that you could just download, like Umbrel or Citadel or stuff like that. Of course, that all happened, and I would say the target audience or the addressable market shrank exponentially, because why should you pay like a few $100 for a node if you just can like download one for free and set it up yourself with like 3 clicks? We had great plans, but in the end, Bitbox is a startup. We're more than 20 people, which is quite sizable, but still we need a lot of focus. So eventually we decided, okay, let's do one thing, let's do that well. And we really focused on the Bitbox O2 or cold wallet that allows you to securely and easily secure your own Bitcoin.
Question, is the Raspi Bolt the same as the Raspi Blitz, or is that a different, is it within it? Like, or was that a different implementation?
They share some history. So I created like the guide. And
okay.
Rootsol, which is the head of Raspi Blitz, then basically created scripts that automate the guide to be used at hack days. Because of course, if you have a hack day, you don't want to spend like manually copy pasting like for a full day, like your Linux command line stuff. So he basically took the Raspi Bolt guide and automated it, and that became Raspi Blitz.
I asked because that was the first node that I set up and it was just like a fun, like I learned a lot just through
getting
confused and, you know, looking up other stuff and trying to figure out, okay, what the hell am I actually doing here with this? But it was a really cool experience. And I think, you know, even for folks that aren't technical, like it can be a very fun thing to do because it actually makes you learn about this stuff. Like what is it actually, not just reading the words on a page, like you have kind of this theoretical idea of it, but in practice, what does this mean? What are the actual challenges that you run into? And it's really fun, honestly.
So this is still like these two things are where my heart is at. So I'm a full node maximalist and like I would say a Bitcoin minimalist. So the full node part of the self-sovereignty is really important to me for the Raspi Bolt, which is still like available today and quite up to date. At raspibolt.org is basically a full node with Lightning as the cherry on top, while most other full nodes are like a Lightning node first and maybe a full node. So for me, the on-chain full node, like having my own consensus rules, enforcing them when receiving transaction, that was the main driver. And now I progressed more and more into like secure self-custody with hardware wallets and stuff like that.
Yeah. And let's actually get into that a little bit, because, you know, I think this is a good, talking with you is a really great opportunity to give people kind of why you should care and what you can do to keep your Bitcoin as secure as possible for the long haul. Because if you just have, you know, let's say if you just have a few sats, whether, you know, maybe don't even keep a few sats on an exchange, but do whatever you want, but you could put them on a hot wallet, you know, put exactly. Them on your phone. And if you've got, you know, $100 worth, like you don't need to go and spend $150 on a hardware wallet. But once you start accumulating more sats, maybe you're buying them, maybe you're earning them by doing some freelance work, whatever you might be doing, you're going to want to keep that safe for the long haul. And How do you think, I guess maybe just like zooming out, how do you explain self-custody to people? Why does that even matter? Why should somebody who is, you know, just getting into Bitcoin now care about that? And, you know, they just, let's say they've just started going down the rabbit hole, and it's like, why does self-custody matter at all?
So I think it really depends on what your original motivation is. Just last Saturday, we were at the Stock Exchange Day Zurich, where we actually were one of the two Bitcoin companies in the exhibition, like having a full booth and selling and like explaining and spreading and orange pilling, like really TradFi people. And for these, I usually tell them, because they come from an investment point of perspective, or maybe they want a hedge against like the financial system failing, or a hedge against like inflation. For them, I think it the main motivation is, if you buy gold, which would be the traditional thing to do before Bitcoin was around for this purpose, you have the choice between buying like a Bitcoin, a gold ETF, or physical gold. And everybody understands that's not the same thing, because we know there's about like 8 times more gold ETF going around than there's actual physical gold. So it works as long as it works. And if shit hits the fan, maybe you're going to lose out with your paper gold. So then I always go like explain that the Bitbox is basically just like the magical safe that you put your digital gold in, because you would also not stack like gold bars in your kitchen cupboard. And there you can play a lot of fun stuff, because like cryptography and Bitcoin is really magic. You can just like tell them, okay, you buy like this digital gold and just like magically appears in your safe. You don't even need to open it. It's like so much fun stuff going on. And this is where I basically like try to like bridge the gap to boomers, or like more traditional people. But of course, if you're like depending on Bitcoin more as a money, not as an investment, then I think there's really no choice, because if you have your Bitcoin on an exchange, they're only allowed to send it to you. You cannot send really, at least in Europe, exchanges are not allowed to take any Bitcoin address. So you cannot pay for stuff. You cannot use it as money. It's just kept somewhat safe for you, but to actually use it and liberate your Bitcoin, you need to receive it first into your own wallet, and then you can actually use it as money. So, and of course, there are many more aspects to it, because like Bitcoin is really like an onion. You can look at it in so many layers, and it never stops, basically. But I think these would be the two main explanations I could give why self-custody is really important.
I think that's such an important point about when it's on an exchange. First of all, it's not yours, but it's also, it's the paper version, right? You're trusting a custodian, whether it's, you know, in an exchange, at least you do hopefully have the option to withdraw it, as long as they don't for some reason block you and say, actually, we need to know a little bit more information about where this is going. Whereas in a Bitcoin ETF, it's like you're not going to get, you're not going to redeem any Bitcoin there. You can't, you know, go to the ETF and say, I'd like the Bitcoin now. It's like, no, you're holding an abstraction of that Bitcoin. And that maybe that's fine for some, you know, do what you want with your money. But if you want to use Bitcoin as money, and it is the best money humans have ever discovered, you have to be able to freely transact with it, to hold it yourself. And the only way to do that is to have self-custody, whether it be on a hot wallet or in cold storage. Can you talk a little bit about, because, you know, okay, there's self-custody. Even if it's in a hot wallet, that's in my self-custody. I have control of that. There's nobody who can stop me from sending that to anyone I want. But why do hardware wallets exist in the first place? Why should people who start to stack some, a meaningful amount of sats look at hardware wallets as the next step for them?
For me, it really comes down to your like personal like risk estimation, or however you want to call it. I mean, for me, like a hot wallet is super convenient, and I need to highlight it's not either or. most people have both, because you can have like a hot wallet on your phone that has like Lightning support and all the cool stuff. And this is perfectly fine for a few hundred bucks. Maybe you have like the same amount typically that you would also carry around in your physical wallet in cash. But of course, nobody would like lug around their life savings every day in their wallet, in their back pocket, because stuff can happen. There are pickpockets out there. And the same goes for hot wallets. They're pretty safe, but just from a like a threat model, the keys that secure your coins, they are exposed to potentially harmful applications, because you need to have programmatically accessible keys to receive and send Bitcoin. So they need to be accessible to your applications. And if they are accessible on a phone, it's even a bit more secure, I would say, than on a desktop, which is for some quite counterintuitive because the apps are more like sandboxed. But still, maybe you have like a malicious version of Candy Crush, and that just like, if they just get access to this one secret, they could just drain your whole wallet. And maybe it's not even right now. Maybe it's just weeks or months later. Maybe they're just collecting stuff. And at one point, they just like drain all the wallets. So the keys to your funds are just exposed on a hot wallet. And this is where cold wallets or hardware wallets come in. And of course, nobody's going to buy a hardware wallet for more than $100 if they just have like $100-$200 of Bitcoin. But at some point, there's no way around it, that after a certain amount of stacking, you just need to invest a little bit into security, and hardware wallets are the way to go. Regardless which one you take, every hardware wallet, the reputable ones, is better than no hardware wallet, I would say.
I think it's another, just an important frame of reference for people to think about their Bitcoin stack. Like, okay, it's, if you're measuring it in dollars, right, in that dirty fiat currency, it's worth whatever it is today, right? But I think it's helpful for people to say, okay, what if this was worth 10 times as much? What if it was worth 20, 50 times as much? Would I feel comfortable with my security setup in that case? Because Bitcoin can do very unexpected things very quickly, and the value, the fiat value of your stack can grow incredibly rapidly. And all of a sudden you may be sitting there, you were comfortable, you have stuff on a hot wallet on your phone, but all of a sudden it's worth 10 times as much. And you're saying, oh, wow, I don't feel comfortable having this much Bitcoin just sitting here on my phone, having the keys sitting here on my phone. You know, the Bitcoin is just, it's just floating in the ether, right? You're in control of those keys, the key to the vault. Maybe that's actually another good question, is for hardware wallets, people also call them hardware signing devices. What analogy do you use to talk about this? You mentioned kind of the vault earlier, or, you know, the like a safety deposit box type thing. How do you explain this to somebody who is just coming in, just trying to get their bearings of like, okay, what is this thing that looks like a USB stick? What is this actually doing for me? What does this mean?
So personally, I don't really like the term hardware signing device, because it's a very technical term. Feels like it's engineering driven. And if we want to make Bitcoin more accessible, I think it's not enough to have like cool cypherpunk devices, like signing devices. You actually need like a fully fleshed out product, like something that comes with instruction, with a wizard, like that aids you in every step of setting it up, that has like, it includes a customer support, the knowledge base, stuff like that, which you don't really buy when you buy just a hardware signing device. But I think it's equally important to have like a good to guide new users so that they feel secure and well taken care of when they do this kind of scary step from like 0 to 1 is maybe buying Bitcoin, but then like 1 to 100 is actually like withdrawing them into your own custody. That can be a scary thing. So I think it should be as easy as possible. And that this is what we try to do, to make like a very accessible version of like all these cool cypherpunk tech, that it abstracts a lot of the scary stuff. And I'm not sure if there's even like an additional metaphor needed. I think a vault or a bank, whatever you said before, is probably already good enough, because people are like they understand what that is. The magic stuff comes on top, that you can just like send from one box to the next without opening them or whatever, in a trustless way. But people don't really need to care about that in the beginning.
I think that that's a good point, is that sometimes, like, some of us enjoy nerding out on these things, right? And going really deep into it. And some people can really go extremely deep into it because they have far more technical prowess than I do. But for the average person who's just trying to, okay, who wants to protect the value of their time and energy and save it in, you know, maybe they've come to the realization that, wow, Bitcoin is the only real money that exists right now. Everything else is you know, credit-based, debt-based, fiat currency that will debase forever. Or there's this nice shiny metal that that people still use and that stores value pretty well across time, but is really inconvenient in the information age, right? It just doesn't work that well. So they've come to that realization that, wow, Bitcoin is different than all this. It's better. But they don't necessarily want to go deep down the technical side of the rabbit hole. They just want to be able to protect the value of that time and energy with something that's easy to use, easy to understand. So maybe this is a good time to just kind of to talk about Bitbox specifically a little bit, because Bitbox is a sponsor of this show. For that, I'm very grateful. And I had not used a Bitbox until you guys sent me one. You sent me one prior to the sponsorship, because you said before you agree to a sponsorship, we'd like you to make sure you really like our product. And I appreciated that. I thought that was very cool, because I also don't want to promote anything that I haven't personally used and tried and really like. And I started using it and I was like, oh my God, this is so simple. Like, this is really so easy to use. And I've set up many hardware wallets. I've helped, you know, friends and family do it. Used a bunch of different kinds. I like probably just about all of them that are out there that are the modern reputable ones. And Bitbox kind of blew me away a little bit, because it was truly so fast and easy to set up without sacrificing security. So can you walk through a little bit kind of, you know, you mentioned you're wanting to make this simple for people, but can you walk through like how you guys actually did that? What was the methodology behind it? What's kind of your driving force when you're thinking about your user? What does that user's story look like? And how do you build your products around that?
So first, thanks a lot for your warm words. I really appreciate that.
It's the truth. Like, it was just a great experience setting it up. I loved it. It's fun when something works exactly as it's supposed to and is really simple. And honestly, it's something when something's hard to fuck up. Like, I like that.
Exactly. I think this is one of our main drivers, that security doesn't really need to be like complicated. So for us, security or simplicity is part of security, because you can have like something super secure, but if the user just does something stupid, like speaking bluntly, then the product sucks as well, because you shouldn't be able to just like shoot yourself in the foot. So of course, for us as like Bitcoin Core engineers, like a long time Bitcoiners, and like, I mean, Bitbox was co-founded by Jonas Schnelli, the Bitcoin Core maintainer. It's always a challenge to like not build something like really cool that basically we want, although we do that regularly, but we try to balance it out. So for example, Bitbox was the first signing device that was able to send to to silent payment addresses. So this is something cool that we did, but we always need to also take a step back and ask ourselves, okay, who are we building this for? And in this regard, of course, like the whole product management process is very important. We're like minimalist is one of our core values, next to transparency and security and all that stuff, of course. And for example, we started, I'd say like more than 2 years ago, with also offering like white glove onboarding calls. So you can buy a Bitbox in our shop and immediately book a 1 hour call that we help you set it up. This is not like something that makes a significant amount of money for us, but it's a really great tool to get like immediate feedback where people are like struggling, where the friction points are, where they need help. And that allows us again to like improve the product. The same goes with support. I think we have one of the best supports out there, I would say. And we constantly are in contact with like support agents tell us, okay, this is like, this keeps happening. How can we fix it? That it's also in our self-interest, because we know that like support is one of the hardest things to scale. So if we fix stuff before that, then we don't even get the tickets. So that's good. And yeah, I mean, overall, I would say keep it simple. Do not everything that is possible. Although the Bitbox app has like a quite significant advanced user section. It has like full node support, Tor network support, all that stuff. But it's not in your face. If you look for it, you can find quite a few cool things that we like to use ourselves. But if you set it up, it's pretty straightforward. And I would say, like, we did a speed run, like setting up a Bitbox in under a minute, which is maybe wow. Not something you should try to do if you read all the disclaimers and set the checkboxes. Maybe you should take a bit more time. But it's definitely possible to set up the Bitbox, including the first backup, in under 5 minutes, because it also has like the micro USB card, which is your first backup. Of course, you can always show the 12 or 24 words as well, and we encourage that, to have like some backup redundancy. But just having the first experience of setting up a wallet, not you being confronted with 12 or 24 strange words, you don't know how these are tied in. Is this the future of money, like that I now need to write down words, even in a foreign language for us? This mnemonic anxiety, as Douglas usually calls it, our CEO, is really like something that we wanted to get rid of. And I think it really pays off, because now you can also set up the Bitbox for a friend of yours and you're never exposed to the 24 words, because otherwise you basically need to leave the room while the other guy like writes down the words, right? It's like such a strange like process.
That's actually such an interesting point, because as I mentioned, I've helped a good amount of friends and family set up hardware wallets, you know, just doing what I can to help them. Okay, they've acquired, you know, a decent little stack of sats, and okay, let me get you a hardware wallet as a, you know, a Christmas present or something like that. And there's always that weird point where it's like, okay, they think they've got a little bit of a handle of like what Bitcoin is. They don't at this point, you know, they're barely peeping down the rabbit hole, but that's okay. But then you hit them with like, you know, setting up a ledger or something. And it's like, all right, you've plugged this in, and now I'm just going to like look away. I'm going to go in the other room and get a beer, and you write down these 24 words. What are these 24 words? Exactly. Well, they're your seed phrase. You know, remember I told you about this. I sent you that podcast that you didn't listen to and that article you didn't read. And now just write these down. I don't want to look at these, because you shouldn't let anyone see these, because these are basically the keys to everything that you have right now. These words are the keys to everything. Like people get a little more freaked out by it and just kind of like, whoa, okay, I didn't know I was getting into all this. And granted, you can make the argument that like, well, they should know that they're getting into it, and they should figure it out, and there's, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, da da da. But like, let's be practical, let's be realistic here. People want something that's going to be simple and easy, but still be secure and make them feel secure. And I think that micro SD backup is really nice. Can you talk about that a little bit more? Because as you mentioned, you can still, if you're, you know, in the Bitbox app, you can still show your words. You can still show your mnemonic. It's no problem.
Not in the app, but yeah, with it, so that it's shown on
exactly.
The device.
Yes, yeah, sorry. But the micro SD backup, you can do that literally right away. Can you guys talk about why, like, is that for anyone that's worried, like, oh, okay, I'm putting my seed on this SD card. Is that, you know, is that secure? Do I need to worry about that? Is that another potential point of failure? What was the choice behind adding that into the workflow to kind of not have the seed phrase be first and foremost, but to have the micro SD backup be first and then seed phrase, okay, later at your leisure?
Yeah. So, I mean, we started our journey about in 2015 with the BitBox 01, which is no longer on sale because back then everybody just came up with their own idea of a hardware wallet. There was like nothing that you could reference. It was the same time the first Trezor came out, like even Ledger came later. So it didn't have a display, but it already had a micro SD card, and it was actually an encrypted micro SD card backup, which is an important distinction to the BitBox 02, which has an unencrypted micro SD card backup, which many people like question, how can that be secure? But in the end, only a transparent backup is a real backup, because if you need a backup of the password for your backup, then maybe your backup is not really a backup. It's just like something in between. And in the end, the micro SD card backup is just exactly the same like your 24 words. So even you can skip it if you want. If you really don't want it, you can skip it and go straight to the recovery words. But we usually recommend, well, you already have a micro SD card in the packaging, so it comes with everything. You don't need to buy like everything individually. So just use it. And if you don't want to keep it separate, just like stick it to the back of your backup, like your paper backup. So because if you ever like recover the 24 word seed phrase on a 2-button device, you know that can easily take 15 minutes or more, especially if you like somehow mess up in the middle. So having a micro SD card to restore your full wallet in like 10 seconds is really convenient. And of course you can like store multiple backups on the same micro SD. So you can even like swap between wallets very easily, without restoring manual all the time, which takes like ages. So of course, if you want like added protection, you can still use like an optional passphrase, which is never stored on the micro SD card. It's actually not even stored on the BitBox itself. So it's really, you need to put it in and then the device unlocks itself and calculates everything. But if you plug it out, the information is lost and gone. So there's no way that an attacker could like get the optional passphrase from within the device because it's never even stored there. But as it's not stored on the backup, it also adds like an additional kind of indirect encryption to your backup, which the same is true for the 24 words, right? So you can like encrypt your 24 words with an optional passphrase, and exactly the same is true for the micro SD as well. It's just like very convenient and so much easier for new people to get into like actually creating their own first wallet, because I think first impression matters. And then you can like at your leisure like receive your first Bitcoin, send your first Bitcoin, and then write down your recovery words a little bit after. So we don't really force you to go all in at the very first second of your BitBox experience.
Since we're talking about BitBox, let's talk about saving you money on a BitBox 02 hardware wallet. Just go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker for 5% off the fully open source Bitcoin only BitBox 02 hardware wallet. Then get your Bitcoin off the exchange and into your own self-custody. As you've been hearing from Staticus, the BitBox team is the real deal. They build easy-to-use, secure, open-source solutions to help keep your Bitcoin safe. And like you'll hear later in this episode, BitBox is one of the only two wallets to actually address the dark Skippy vulnerability. So if you have a BitBox, you're in luck. Plus, and I cannot emphasize this part enough, the BitBox O2 is truly easy as hell to use. Whether you're brand new to Bitcoin, it's your first time setting up a hardware wallet, or you are a well-seasoned psychopath. It is Bitcoin only, and again, it is fully open source. You can head to their GitHub and verify for yourself. There's no need to trust me or to trust BitBox. When you go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker, not only do you get 5% off, but you also help support this fucking podcast. So thank you.
I think it's a nice way to like slowly wade into the Bitcoin waters for people who are new to this. And even for myself, like again, I'd set up many hardware wallets before, and it was a very just enjoyable experience to go through it. I actually like the way that you guys have navigation. It's not buttons, it's like touches and sliders. I found it much faster than just like clicking these little buttons a million times. That's just me. Maybe some people don't like it as much. I thought it was quite nice. But, you know, okay, so zooming out a little bit, what do you have any tips as far as just general best practices for people when they've gone, they've set up their hardware wallet. They have this seed phrase now, and maybe if they're using a BitBox, they have a micro SD backup as well, and maybe it's just taped to the back of their seed phrase, whatever. Do you guys, or how do you think about, or do you provide any guidance on just how people should really take care of that for the long haul? Because you've got your piece of BitBox hardware, sure, but it is still a piece of hardware. It's got electrical components in it that could potentially degrade. Could maybe you had a flood in your house and there's, you know, a lot of humidity or something like that. Maybe that gets kind of destroyed, or maybe just, you know, you've had it for 10 years, you know, we're 10 years in the future and just who knows, it's not working for some reason. Are there any good tips you can share for people for just kind of looking towards the long-term time horizon? How do I make sure I keep my Bitcoin safe? And when it's in cold storage, I'm using a hardware device, but what else can I do? What else should I do to really make sure it's safe for the long haul?
Yeah, I usually highlight that the signing device itself has certain roles and responsibilities. So it creates your wallet like with maximum entropy. It really needs to be like super random. So that's guaranteed. Also, of course, with like open source firmware, which we can get into a bit more later, I guess. So it's really a trustless way to create your wallet with good entropy. And it keeps your keys usable in insecure environments, because this is the hard part. You have like one digital secret, but you still need to access it with like software. And to do that securely is quite a challenge in like regular computing or on a mobile phone. So this is the part where the hardware wallet really shines. But the backup is equally important, because electronics don't necessarily, they're not made to last decades. They're just not. And stuff can happen. You can lose it. You can like drive over with your car, or can be stolen. They can just like break due to humidity and stuff like that. Although the BitBox, it doesn't have any moving parts. You mentioned like the touch sliders. There's just induction sensors. It doesn't have a battery. So it's even here, like minimalist, keep it simple, I think is really important. But still, I wouldn't recommend the hardware wallet to like count on that for decades. The backup, however, its main job is to the long-term storage of your wallet. And that can be in any medium you choose. Like the micro SD card is the first and most like convenient medium. But of course, then you should write down like the 12 words or the 24 words as well. Here, like if you use like kind like okay-ish paper, maybe acid-free, and use a pencil, that's like... I'm not sure how they call it in English, but like the woodworkers, they know like a pencil can last decades, yeah, if you mark a beam or something with it. So that's already good. But of course, there are other factors like your house could be on fire and stuff like that. So steel could be another medium, but that's really your own like evaluation, what medium you want to use. At least you should have like multiple backups, because one backup is no backup, I would say, as an IT guy. So redundancy is good. Different mediums are good, like electronic and analog. And then it really depends where you can put the backup. You should have somewhere kind of safe, but of course you can also split it up if you use like paper backup, stuff like that. So there are many ways, also with the optional passphrase. Unfortunately, there's really no one size fits all answers to this, but we do have like quite a few blog posts on that where, okay, what are the five biggest misconceptions about backups, or how advanced technologies are available to additional secure your backup. So if you're getting into that, I think there's great material out there just to make your own personal choice.
What would you say regarding just like multi-sig versus single sig? So because you mentioned, you know, either creating additional copies of your backup or maybe splitting your backup up, like, or, and when you say that, I assume you mean like taking those 24 words, chopping them in three. That I always get a little bit nervous about, because it's like if you lose one part of that, well, you're screwed. Well, versus, you know, like is that something that you would recommend?
That you should not do. But there's okay, like this thing called like poor man's Shamir secret, where you can like split your 24 words into three parts, and you need two of these parts because each part has eight words missing, which is secure today, maybe not secure in 10 years. So it comes with a caveat, because like brute forcing attacks, of course, get more powerful over time. But for now, it's kind of okay. But you're right, multisig is definitely the answer going forward if you're trying to like secure larger sums where you want to avoid single point of failures. Because even if you like split your backup, even with poor man's or proper Shamir secret, you still need to combine the secret at one point to actually be able to create new receive addresses, like and like really check them, verify them, or of course to send Bitcoin. So there's again a single point of failure where you could be attacked or whatever. With multisig, you can like avoid all that, because you can force yourself to not have access to all the signing locations at the same time. Maybe you need to go really cumbersome to travel even in multiple cities or banks or whatever you have at your disposal. So this is something that scales really well. Unfortunately, it's for the common Joe, it's just not usable enough today. There are too many issues where you can really like mess up with the backups. With you also need to store a lot of additional metadata. It's not rocket science, but it's not something I could like wholeheartedly recommend to like normie friends. So I think this is, for me personally, I think this is one of the next big frontiers where we really need to work on making this more accessible. And the technology is here, but like improve the UX, like improve like messaging between signers, because it's not only like different locations, it can also be different people, but then how do you send around these partially signed Bitcoin transactions and all that stuff. So there are great wallets out there, but they're all a bit nerdy and technical still. But I hope we get there in the next few years.
And for those people wondering, can BitBoxes be used for multi-sig setups, just like any hardware wallet? Like, is there anything that are there certain types of hardware wallets that are not advantageous for this, or are there basically anything that's out in the market right now you can use it for a multi-signature, as one key in a multi-signature wallet?
So in a multi-sig setup, you always have like a central coordinator that like it's basically the wallet, but the wallet that talks with multiple signing devices, and this coordinator creates your unsigned transactions and stuff like that. And then when you're actually signing a transaction, it can be a really hard challenge for a stateless device, like a regular hardware wallet, to really validate what it's signing, because part of the transaction, for example, are the extended public keys of all cosigners. And I think this is where the Bitbox really shines. When you first show an address or receive coins in a multisig wallet, you're actually registering the multisig wallet on the device. So the Bitbox is not stateless. It remembers your hardware wallet. And in case the coordinator should be malicious, it can detect that it tries to do something shady. Just an example, if you have like three devices and you're signing with one, the coordinator could just like add two more cosigners that are originally not part of the setup, which are controlled by an attacker. But then if you sign, the attacker already has the majority of all the overall transaction, right? So if the coordinator tries to swap out cosigners, the hardware wallet needs to be able to detect that. And that's a real challenge for most hardware wallets. And I think this is where the Bitbox really shines.
Can you, just for someone who might not be familiar, can you explain what a stateless device is? Just because you used that word earlier, some people might be thinking, okay, what are we talking about here? You know, just trying to make sure that for those listening that may not be as technically savvy, they get the full picture.
I'm glad you're keeping my IT stuff accountable. So stateless basically means it forgets everything. So it knows itself, its own seed, but that allows a stateless device also to securely verify a single sig transaction, because the app, the companion app, whatever that is, sends an unsigned transaction to the hardware wallet, and the hardware wallet can check, okay, this is actually like the inputs I expect. They are controlled by myself. This is the change address is also controlled by myself. So if you can trick a hardware wallet into signing something and all the change goes to a different address that is not under its control, that's not supposed to happen. And a hardware wallet must definitely be able to detect that. It becomes more tricky when in a multisig setup, when the hardware wallet only knows itself, because that's not enough to verify it if a transaction is safe. So with the change address, the coordinator could just lie and add a different change address, but the hardware wallet cannot verify it, because to verify the change address, it needs to know the other cosigners' XPUBs as well. And if you plug it out or whatever, and it forgets everything, there's no real way to do that. And we don't really want to like manually check the XPUBs every time you generate a receive address or send a transaction. That's an option, of course, but it's not. I doubt people will actually do that.
Yeah, I appreciate the explanation, and I think that multisig is something for those who are. Maybe if you've already set up a single sig wallet and you're very comfortable with your Bitcoin in cold storage, and maybe a little way down the line, again, you're stacking more and more, hopefully contributing value to society and getting Bitcoin in exchange. As your stack grows, and again, thinking about your stack, like, okay, it's not just my stack today, but what's the purchasing power of this in fiat? 10x this, yeah. You know, in a few years, like it, because it will be, it's going to get there. Multisig is a great thing for people to look at. And I think it's nice to know that there are some of the potential pitfalls that you can run into. Again, you know, it's why I like working with Bitbox, because the more I learn about you guys, it's like, oh, wow, you guys thought of a lot of stuff. Clearly a lot of thought was put into this. And with multisig, I kind of see like these two sort of buckets where it's like complete do-it-yourself multisig. Like I've used Nunchuck in the past, for that, which is, for those who don't know, it's a pretty cool app. And they made a lot of improvements, but you can set up your own, entirely your own multisig, or, you know, set up and coordinate with other people to set up a multisig. I did that as well for a shared wallet we were managing some donations for, and worked really well. Learned a lot about UTXO management through that experience as well, as a part of that. It's a different story though. But then there's also like kind of the, I don't know if you'd call it assisted multisig, like what Casa does, where it's basically, okay, Casa is holding one of your keys. You're holding two of your keys. So if you lose one of those, you know, one of those two keys that you have, you still have two out of three in the multi-sig, one that you have, one that Casa has. So you can still, okay, you know, generate a new key or move those coins, do whatever you want. Do you think that as we move forward, do you think we'll see a trend more towards the kind of do-it-yourself multi-sig, or is the managed assisted multi-sig going to end up being more of the what more people gravitate towards? Because it's like people are scared, honestly, of having everything in their own control. Like some people want somebody else to have kind of, you know, still one of the keys to the castle. They can't do anything with it. They can't open the door. They can't open the vault, but they can help you open the vault if you're there. What's your take on that? How do you see that kind of progressing?
I really do hope that there will be room for both. So personally, I'm a big fan of Sparrow Wallet, which I use for multi-sig myself, also for like company stuff. Although we actually use different wallets and they interoperate really well if you use Electrum, and everybody uses a different wallet and it still works with the same wallet, kind of. But like there should be a choice, right? If I'm comfortable with setting up my own multisig, this gives me the ultimate sovereignty in managing my funds. It has the best privacy. It's low cost, because of course every time you have a service that aids you and guides you, there's usually a subscription involved, so you pay a yearly fee. You get something in return, which is probably convenience and assistance. And there are all, because Bitcoin is programmable money, there can be very creative things like we're co-signing like all your stuff automatically up to a certain threshold, unless like some risk management like shows red flags. And if you want to spend more than, $10,000 a day or whatever, then you need to like hop on a video call or authenticate yourself separately with a YubiKey or whatever. Like it's really limitless. And this is stuff that only works really with a service. But of course, there's also like the privacy downside, because like a Casa or an Unchained, they basically know every transaction you spend because they're involved in they're co-managing the wallet with you. So I think it's really important to have the choice. Do I want to do it myself? Like full sovereignty, maybe my own full node, my own coordinator, my own devices, maybe even multi-vendor, multi-sig, just to be like super extra secure. But there definitely needs to be also something that is more accessible. And I hope it's going to be an assisted multi-sig and not just like banks offering like custody, because that's then... Yeah.
then we're right back where we started. We've exactly. Added back in the middlemen, right? Yeah,
exactly. No,
I think that's a good point. Even just like on a personal level, it's like I use both, you know, without giving too much away. But I, you know, I've got a hot wallet with a little petty cash in it that I use for zaps on Nostr. Let's be honest, I have like probably 15 different Lightning wallets on my phone because I like to play around and nerd out with it. But none of them has more than a few sats in it, you know. But they're really useful. Or if I go to conferences and I need to, you know, somewhere where I can actually spend some Bitcoin in person, then I want to have a little bit in a hot wallet, but never enough where if my phone got stolen or broken or lost, I would be like, oh my God, I'm ruined. You know, no, I want to be able to say, oh, well, actually I'm more worried that I lost the phone, 'cause that's worth more than the, exactly. You know, the Bitcoin that I had on it. But then having multi-sig setups and distributing those keys and having it be so, you know, because I think Bitcoiners, especially as the price goes up, will naturally worry about, you know, the $5 wrench attack. It's like, okay, somebody comes to your house and says, I know you're an Anon, but I figured out that you are this person and I think you have a bunch of Bitcoin and I'm going to, you know, smack you in the head with a wrench or break, you know, kidnap someone in your family until you give me your Bitcoin.
Yeah. Definitely.
And if you literally can't give that to them, that also presents its own problems, because then it's like, who, if the attacker is just a moron and you tell them, well, I have a multi-sig setup, I literally can't do anything. Like you can break both my kneecaps, I won't be able to do anything for you. Like they'll be like, Well, I don't believe you, Walker. I don't know what a multi-sig is. So give me all your Bitcoins that you're keeping there. You know, like you never know. Like it's not a situation to find yourself in.
This is not a new problem, right? Because we already have millionaires and billionaires that, well, they just don't have immediate access to their fiat or gold or whatever. Yeah. And that's widely known. So this is why there maybe in Brazil or whatever, there's like more of a extortion stuff going on. But in like a semi-secure, like first world countries, it's not really a thing. Because thieves know it's kind of pointless. So right. I think that should become the norm as well for Bitcoin, to not have everything like in your drawer next to you and just like be able to have immediate access to your life savings. So this is also why I don't keep anything at home except the stuff on my phone or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a good piece of advice for Bitcoiners in general, is you do not want to be able to access your entire stash at the drop of a hat. Yes. Like, granted, let's say, okay, the other scenario there is maybe you want to leave the country or something. Okay. And you need to do it quickly. Maybe you need to have a plan in place to be able to go and get access to that Bitcoin. But you really... you don't want to be able to be in a situation where somebody can force you to move your coins just at a moment's notice. Like that's a generally a very good piece of advice, is don't put yourself in that situation. And do you mind me asking? I mean, I assume you're based in Switzerland, given that yes. Bitbox is a Swiss company. The nice thing about Switzerland and the U.S. is Switzerland, I believe, has about 45 guns per 100 people. The United States, I think, has about 120 guns per 100 people. We have more guns than people. I grew up in Wisconsin and I grew up hunting. So I've been around guns my whole life. And I know in Switzerland, there's a very, because there's the kind of like militia or like military training, there's a very big respect for guns, and people keep them either a service weapon or another weapon in their home. And Switzerland actually has insanely low gun crime, though. I was just looking at the statistics. It's much lower than America, even though you guys have one of the highest gun ownership rates in the world, which is kind of incredible. This is totally off topic, but can you talk about that culture at all? Just like the fact that you guys, you know, people say it's like, oh, you know, guns are the reason that people get killed. And it's like, well, the gun isn't pulling the trigger, the person is. And clearly in Switzerland, you have tons of guns, 45 per every 100 people, but there's not just a bunch of people getting murdered. Like, I think the majority of your gun deaths was like, it's like 300 a year or something, and it's mainly from suicide. So it's like, what's that culture like around gun ownership there? Because that is really the last line of defense against the $5 wrench attack is the, well, I've got a gun, you know?
Well, I don't know enough to talk about the U.S. situation, to be honest. And I don't really want to go into like contentious politics.
Oh, no, but we don't have to. I'm just curious about Switzerland specifically. What we do have in
Switzerland, I also like, I'm experienced with guns. And I mean, if you're like every male needs to go to the military, because we do have a militia. Like almost everything is militia in Switzerland. Politics, fire. I was also a firefighter. It's basically purely militia. There's almost no professionals, and it works because we take it serious. And every service member also gets like a pretty good, a damn good like automatic rifle. I think it's accurate up to 700 meters or something like that. So pretty good. 20 shots. Like immediately, like no throttling. And if you're no longer in the military, you can just keep it if you want. And also you're in the military until I think you're 44 or something like that, or 30. That's about 40. I was discharged quite a while back. And you need to go like shooting every year just to do like the mandatory training. But we also do have background checks. So it's not that like every nut can just walk into a store and come out with like 3 pistols and 2 automatic rifles. So there's definitely regulation. which I think is fair, because I don't want like every psychologically challenged person to just like stock up on like an insane amount of weapons. But I guess in the end, it's more like a cultural difference, because you have that, all that stuff in your constitution. It's like coming from the revolution, and like it's really inbred into the American society. For us, it's not that like emotional topic. It's a gun is a gun, and we're happy if we don't need to use them.
Absolutely. I hope to never need to use a gun on another human being. That is something I don't think anyone, I mean, unless you're a psycho, wants to do. In America, we do have background checks. This is kind of a misnomer that people have. Like if I bought another gun recently in a different state, but I was held to my own state's laws, which means I was not allowed to buy. I had to buy a semi-automatic shotgun because I wasn't allowed to buy a pistol in the state. I already have. I was looking for another pistol, but I had to buy a semi-automatic shotgun, which is kind of funny. They'll let you buy a semi-automatic shotgun, but you can't buy a pistol again. But there's a 3-day waiting period. You have to run a full background check. So you can't, just go in, grab a gun and, pay it and walk out. There are some processes in place, but, we don't have to get into that too much. I was just curious about, cause again, it's the sort of the last line of defense, for a person who is, if your home is invaded, like, and you pray that never happens and you never have to use it. But I find the culture, in Switzerland to be really fascinating, because it's kind of a model example of, look, there is high gun ownership, but there's also high social cohesion. There's a lot of emphasis put on personal responsibility. And, maybe that's also why there's a lot of emphasis on security in general. The Swiss bank account for many years has been the gold standard, if you will.
Yeah.
I wanted to get your take on that. So I appreciate the little digression there.
Sure.
away from guns and back to Bitcoin a little bit. What do you, because, okay, if we talk about scaling Bitcoin, like realistically speaking, in the coming years, not every person is going to be able to have a UTXO, right? Many people are going to be priced out. They won't be able to have a UTXO to their name. An unspent transaction output, for those who are curious what this acronym means. How do you guys, as a company building in the Bitcoin space, think about Bitcoin as it goes forward? Do you think that Bitbox will stay as kind of as a hardware focused company? Do you guys see yourselves building other sorts of solutions? Because, I mean, this isn't going to happen right away, obviously. We're talking down the line, but just gaming this out, at a certain point, it's going to be hard to sell more hardware wallets because there's not going to be people with UTXOs to secure. So do you guys think about that at all? I mean, is that just too far? Like right now, you're a startup, you're still building up. Am I just like way too far out in the future? Or do you guys think about that at all?
No, of course. I mean, it's even today, it's an important part of the user journey. And this is also why we're adding Lightning functionality to the Bitbox app. Which, to be clear, is not like hardware security. So we already see today that if you go to meetups, if you're at conferences, if you pay with Bitcoin, you don't want to like take out your hardware wallet and sign something publicly. So you already have like a Lightning wallet on your phone to do that. And I think in combination with like a very like user-friendly on-chain wallet like the Bitbox app already is, there's a great use case to also have a hot wallet in the same app where you can easily like top up from your cold storage into your hot wallet. And then of course it should not be like just on-chain. Like I love Phoenix wallet. It's basically just like you liberate your UTXO. It's all now in the Lightning network. It's like available and accessible for like smallest purchases. And this is what we want to build as well. So we're currently building like Lightning functionality. And this will bring a hot wallet into the BitBox app that you can, of course, then like easily like top up from your cold storage. So that's, of course, only a first step. If UTXOs are no longer a topic, I don't have an answer for you. We're not quite there yet.
Yeah, we've got a few.
But I could very well imagine that Bitcoin in the long run, let's say decades, just becomes more of the plumbing of the like the overlaying like new financial system. Because I'm an IT guy, and when I like in 2017, like the block size wars and all that stuff, which started way earlier, this is also what radicalized me, because for me it was so obvious that you cannot put everything on the blockchain. It doesn't make any sense if I buy like a coffee that this U2XO is like announced to every participant of the network worldwide and needs to be stored on all nodes. So everything in IT is built in layers. And the good thing about building in layers is that you can also experiment. So the base layer, like blockchain, on-chain, UTXOs, and then you can build different stuff on top of that. And the new stuff is allowed to fail without like dragging down the base layer. So you can like build up, and I think we have like now 7 layers in the networking stack. And if you watch YouTube or a podcast like this, nobody's talking about like the physical layer where the electronic symbol as like signals go over the wire. But this is basically the first base layer of the networking stack. And I think over time we need to build something like that. And I really do hope that we can preserve like the original like characteristics of Bitcoin. There can be compromises, like even with Lightning today. It's of course a different threat model. It's a different like trust model. But if there are multiple layer twos or then layer 3, 4, whatever, you can choose the one that is best suited for you. And I think if we take care to build good stuff, like in an honest, transparent way, and this is also why open source is so incredibly important, then we can build a new financial system that actually scales without compromising on the core values.
Amen. And I'd love to actually just talk about that ethos a little bit. You guys, you even have a hat that I have one of it. I don't think I have it right here. Oh, maybe I do. It's somewhere. But it says open source everything. And you even open sourced the design for your open source everything hat, which is just, you know, great and kind of hilarious too. But Bitbox is an open source company, like through and yes. Throughout your entire stack.
Yes.
Can you talk about why that is so important to you guys? Because I think it's something for folks who are maybe new to Bitcoin or looking in from the outside saying, this company is just open sourcing all of the cool stuff that it's doing, like what that their proprietary, you know, data. That seems insane when you're looking at it from the fiat mindset. But from the Bitcoin mindset, you view that as a positive thing, as a good thing. You want it to be open source. Can you talk about why Bitbox as a company has that ethos? Why it's and we see it in other companies as well, but why is that so important?
So I think that if we talk about free open source software, there are really, in the context of Bitcoin, there are two different aspects to it. And the first, I think, is pretty like logical, because it's security relevant. I don't want any closed source code touching my private keys. This is like trust minimization. We want to like get rid of all the middlemen without becoming the new middleman ourselves, right? This is why we adhere like fanatically on industry standards. The backup is always recoverable also on competitor devices or even a software device. It can never be like a vendor lock-in. Otherwise, it just, what's the point, right? We're just building something new, like isolated again. And having all the source code available is really important to keep us accountable. Everybody can check that what we are claiming, what the security device does, how it works. Again, creating the initial wallet with maximum entropy is so crucial. It would be one of the most powerful attacks on a wallet if you can like somewhat create deterministic wallets that are already like kind of random, but not random enough, so that with some sort of effort, the person that knows the code could actually replicate the process and in the end, like just drain all the wallets that needs to be open source. And that's not always the case, unfortunately. And just trust, I don't think a fully trustless device will ever be possible, but we're working really, really hard, at least in that direction, to take us out of the picture and just eradicate every trust that we can, that you as a user need to put in us as the manufacturer of the device. And this is, of course, like all the firmware, all the Bitbox app code, everything is open source. You can check every line of code. It's a bit harder with hardware because you cannot really run a checksum over hardware, right? But we do publish like high resolution X-ray images. And what we learned is that you can easily go to your neighborhood's dentist and ask them to X-ray your hardware wallet. It's not even that expensive. And then you just compare it if there are any additional chips or whatever. Of course, that's not what everybody should need to do. And this is why I have cryptographic authenticity checks and all that stuff. But just as a whole, I think it's really important to do everything that we can to reduce the trust. And the second thing is, of course, is the code that we publish also available for others to use and to take? And it was very interesting when we implemented multisig. We were one of the later hardware wallets to actually implement multisig, and it was kind of nice for us because we could avoid mistakes others did. And actually, we did responsible disclosures of security issues to basically every other wallet that had like multisig implemented, including Trezor and Ledger. But that's only possible because we could look at their code, and the industry as a whole is like better off for it. Vice versa, of course, as well. It's not only us. And we also want to, because the second point really is a bit more about ideology. Like Satoshi created Bitcoin as a free open source. And that's the only way it could ever work. Because if there are patents, or if you need to ask for permission or pay licensing fees, then it's no longer an open financial system. So we also want to adhere to that ethos. And yeah, I think for us, it's just like an ideological question on top of the security relevant open source ethos, that we acknowledge that we stand on the shoulder of giants and we are building from there. And we want others to also reuse our work and build even cooler stuff with that.
It's such a beautiful thing, because if you think about like the traditional financial system, it's all yeah, so opaque. Insane. Like, could you imagine like banks being like, yeah, this is how we run our back end software for, you know, like, no, of course they wouldn't do that. They'd be exposing themselves to potentially malicious attacks, but also because it's probably potentially not that secure in the first place. They're not building it to be that way, but there is this.
That's like security by obscurity is something that works in the short run, but it always fails in the long run. And I mean, just look at credit cards. Why are they so expensive? Like if you buy Bitcoin with credit cards, you usually pay like 5-7% of commission. And that's not price gouging. It's just like chargeback risk that they need to cover, because a credit card is basically a piece of plastic where the private key is printed on the front and you hand it to someone else. It's like, it's insane that this works at all, but it kind of does. But of course, there are many drawbacks.
It is. That's a hilarious description also. Just the private key's right there on the front. And it's true. It's like, and you've got the other little codes on the back, and you've got the expiration date, and okay, you're off to the races. Like it's kind of insane. And just speaking of vulnerabilities, one thing I wanted to talk to you about as well was this dark Skippy attack, which for some folks may have seen this talked about on X or on Noster, this vulnerability, basically the a malicious signing device being able to leak your private keys. Can you give kind of the, like, what is this attack? I think for a lot of people, they see some of these, like, these, you know, hacking kind of things on, like, it's done in a white hat way, right? It's done by Bitcoiners who are trying to say, like, look, this is something bad that could happen. We need to make sure we're working on this. But a lot of people who don't have the technical chops to understand this, myself included, look at this and say, oh no, is this something I need to be worried about? Like, do I need to panic? Am I at risk of getting dark skippied? Can you talk about what this is, and is this something people need to be worried about? How does Bitpox protect against this, et cetera?
So I think there, if you're talking about like hardware wallets, there are some advocates that even tell you not to use a hardware wallet because it's like a centralized form of like managing keys. And if there's anything shady happen, then like the manufacturer would be basically able to drain all the wallets. And creating wallets with bad entropy is like the first very powerful attack that can be solved with like open source software and reproducible builds. You need to make sure that the open source code is actually running on your hardware device, not just like the nice GitHub repo. And the second very powerful, I would argue even more powerful attack is if you can somehow leak the private key, like this actual seed phrase that is the root of all private keys, in a way that cannot be prevented either by air gap or a special wallet on your computer, because the private or the seed is actually encoded in a very, very normal looking Bitcoin transaction. And this is what dark skip is about. Previously, we thought it would need about 12 signed transactions to reconstruct the seed. But dark skippy actually showed that if you have a 12-word seed, I think you need two transactions, where a malicious, not an honest wallet, but a malicious hardware wallet can encode your seed phrase into the Bitcoin transaction, which of course is then stored on the blockchain, and the attacker can just go to the blockchain and look it up, which is a very, very powerful attack because it scales so well. If you can somehow manage to get this behavior into a hardware wallet, it doesn't necessarily need to be the manufacturer themselves. It can be a malicious firmware update or a rogue employee or whatever. There need so many security checks in place. If all it takes is two transactions to leak all your private keys onto the blockchain for everybody to look up, you can basically rock pull a whole user base, because you can also like just collect over time and at one point just like get all the coins out. And it, of course, it's like a like take the money and run attack. It's not something that can be done like easily. But it's the second thing why it is so powerful is also because there's quite a bit of plausible deniability. If you can like have a malicious update on some devices and maybe then even afterward replace it with an official release again, maybe you can't even prove anything has been leaked and nobody knows who actually what happened. So the overall industry response to this was a bit surprising to me, because it was basically only downplaying the attack, which I think is not the proper response if somebody like shows a very powerful attack. Of course, it's very inconvenient for some wallets, because even AirGap does not protect against that. And what we did with the Bitboxer 2, we were the first wallet to implement the anti-klepto protocol. I can explain a bit more later. It's very hard to do with the air-gapped wallet because you need multiple signing rounds. And this is where, if you need to scan QR codes or swap micro SD cards or all that stuff, it's just not feasible. So it really works. This protection really only works if you have a kind of a good communication channel. But even before that, AirGap has always been like touted as the silver bullet to security, which it's more of a marketing term, to be honest. We have like a very in-depth article about that where we looked at all potential attacks that are known since 2020, and for no known attack, AirGap would even have helped. It makes you feel secure, but in reality, the attacks are much more subtle, and it's just like the code that does not validate stuff enough or whatever, and you can trick it into signing things that it shouldn't. So as long as there's communication happen, and even with AirGap, it's not proper AirGap because communication needs to flow. It's more of a rate limiting. Yeah, it doesn't help in that regard. Okay. What we did with the Bitbox, just to explain quickly how the anti-klepto protocol works, is that we force... So the dark skippy thing works because every Bitcoin transaction has a few bits where you can put in random stuff. It's called the nonce, and the wallet is basically free to pick whatever it wants to put into that data field. So there are like methods where you can force the hardware wallet to reproducibly like limit its ability, and it's reproducible that you can check, okay, that's actually not like a random data, but it's like predetermined data. But of course, if the hardware wallet itself is malicious, then these checks don't work because it can do whatever it wants. So we use the Bitbox app or any other app, basically, or even over HWI, like Sparrow or Spectre or Electrum, to force the hardware wallet to commit to a nonce and then stick to it. And we can cryptographically check that it actually used the nonce that we gave it from the host device to the hardware wallet. And that we force the hardware wallet and limits its choice to put in random data to actually commit to that, to using that data or that lesser variability, so that it cannot like encode random data into a transaction.
Okay, I appreciate the explanation.
Sorry, and that was a very long.
No. I thought it was excellent, and I think it's important for people to understand this again, because for the average, for somebody who's very technical, this may be really fascinating, right? And they can go deep into what this vulnerability is and what it means and all the far-reaching implications for each type of hardware wallet manufacturer. But for somebody who is just a casual user of Bitcoin, saving in Bitcoin, spending in Bitcoin, they look at this and they say, you're talking about leaking my private keys in a transaction. I don't know how the heck it works. Am I safe or am I not safe?
Yeah.
And the answer, and you know, again, we're talking about if I'm understanding all this correctly, in order for this malicious attack to be executed, this is the kind of attack where there is some sort of break in the security of the hardware wallet manufacturer themselves, where somebody is able to insert either some malicious firmware through an update. They sneak something in, or they, in the manufacturing process, there's some sort of a collusion. Someone is compromised within the organization. And what I'm hearing is that from Bitbox specifically, this vulnerability is protected against because the mechanism by which your private key would be distributed, i.e. in the nonce via inserting parts of your seed into that nonce, that part is protected against. So it basically shuts down the ability to broadcast, for the malicious device to broadcast any sort of seed data from that nonce. And so through that, you're protected. And so if you're using a Bitbox, you can at least rest easy. And again, I think, you know, these attacks, it's like, are they going to happen? You know, probably not, hopefully not, but maybe. Like, and it's all about, you know, okay, what's your, so, you know, you may be using another hardware wallet and that's perfectly fine. You're probably going to be fine, and you know, nobody's going to, you know, execute this attack. but maybe. And like that's the whole thing, right? Like somebody's probably not going to come into your house with a wrench and break your kneecaps, but they might. So multi-sig is a good idea. Somebody's, you know, your house is probably not going to catch on fire and burn your hardware wallet and your paper seed phrase, but it might. So maybe a steel backup is a good idea. Like all of these things I think are really like, they're personal questions about your own risk tolerance and saying, okay, yeah, these things might not happen, but they might. And are you okay with the percentage chance of them happening or not? But if you're not, the nice thing is that there's things that you can do to protect yourself. Like you can sleep easy knowing that, okay, I'm protected against a wrench attack because I've got a multi-sig setup. I'm protected against my house burning down because I've got a nice steel backup. I'm protected against Dark Skippy because I'm using a BitBox. And I think, to their credit, I think Blockstream Jade's wallet also protects against this. And again, that is as deep as I went into this was figuring out, okay, am I going to be protected against this? Yes. Okay. So I appreciate just the explanation. To be clear,
it's not a proprietary solution. So we made sure to that this is now actually like the whole anti-exfil protocol, as Blockstream calls it, or anti-klepto, as we call it. It has been merged into like the core cryptographic libraries of Bitcoin Core. So we made sure to contribute upstream so that everybody else can use it, not to create a unique selling point for us. And it's a very old attack. It's been known for a long time, and we've worked a long time on like this additional security measure. And it's been in the BitBox for 2 years. It's just coming, like seeing the light of day today by chance, because somebody actually demonstrated the attack. But it's been in the BitBox and in Jade for a long time. And in security, this is like called security in depth, right? So we don't want to have any single point of failures, because open source and reproducible builds already protect quite well against stuff like that, so that your hardware wallet does not go rogue. But additional security measures, if that should fail, or if it's a targeted attack and it's maybe not like publicly released, but like just like uploaded on your hardware wallet, like your personal hardware wallet, then this would fail. And then this is where the anti-klepto protocol comes in. So it's always like multiple steps of security. In case something fails, there's a second row and a third row of security measures.
That's what I love about this open source ethos, though, is that it's not like BitBox or Jade is trying to say, we have this specific way to keep you safe. Come to us if you want to stay safe. It's we implemented this and anyone can implement it. And please do implement it. Please, you know, have the best security practices. Like that idea kind of a rising tide is lifting all boats. Like ultimately, you don't want people to get dark skippied. And so I think that's just it's cool to see that level of collaboration within the open source space. I mean, that's what it's all based on, right? Is collaborating to make it a better experience for everyone.
Definitely. And I mean, as a company, we will be successful if Bitcoin is successful. If Bitcoin fails, and like, I don't want to name any, like point out any names, like some other vendor like gets rock pulled, that could easily be like the death of self-custody. So that would also very heavily impact us. So it's in our own self-interest as well to like contribute to the industry to make everybody's self-custody safer. Because in the end, we want to make self-custody the de facto standard, the default way to hold your Bitcoin. And for some, maybe custody is the better way. For others, assisted multisig is because they have like so much corn stacked already, which is also good. But we don't want people flocking into ETFs or just like hold their Bitcoin on a bank account, because to be honest, I think regulation is actually working for us, because Bitcoin in a bank account, at least in Europe, is basically unusable. You cannot do anything with it. The only thing you can do is withdraw, and then you're good. And this is basically where we come in.
Yeah, it gives people something to run away from, regulation, that is. You know, it's like, okay, well, I want to actually be able to use my Bitcoin either in a as close to a self-sovereign way as possible, or in the way that I use it as a store of value, but also as a medium of exchange. I want to be able to send it to who I want. I don't want to have to, mm-hmm. you know,
exactly.
KYC my friends that I'm paying for something like that. Just insane. I think that, God, this is a digression, but the whole KYC regime across the world is just, I think, so destructive, because it doesn't work, first of all.
Yeah.
It doesn't work at all. It catches a tiny, tiny percentage. And then, you know, I think it's like 1%. Like, it's something shockingly small. But then you just create these huge honeypots, like the biggest honeypots you could ever imagine. And it's like, well, that's not serving people. That's not serving the citizens. I don't know who that serves.
It's like a huge cargo cult where you do stuff that looks like nice from the outside, but it doesn't even work because everybody... It's like if you, like, in Europe, again, like, banning, like, encrypted messengers. I mean, what you do is that the regular people, like, we will probably use... Like still, or let's pick another example that regular people, not like us, will probably use like unencrypted. But everybody who has something to hide or is an actual criminal, of course, they will still use like encrypted messages. Why wouldn't they? Are they scared to get like a fine or what?
Right.
What's the point?
Yeah, it's interesting with the whole Telegram CEO getting arrested. I think I just saw the CEO of Rumble just like left Europe as well, because they've been in some sort of legal battles, I think, with the French government as well, maybe a couple others. And I don't know. I read that the declaration from the French government basically against Pavel, saying three of the lines were like, I mean, their law says that you need to have like a license to use cryptology, as they're calling it. And you need to basically tell them what you're doing and, you know, of course, you know, give them a back door because you never know. And it's like, it's just so insane that like criminals use the internet, criminals use pens and paper, and, you know, criminals use guns, and criminals use everything that normal people use. Like you can literally, criminals use freaking, you know, washing machines. Like it's just this insane, insane standard that you have to treat everybody like a criminal because criminals use the same things that everybody uses. And I think, I just think that's so sad and so regressive. And so that is not what is going to help humanity move forward. It just moves us backwards.
And in this regard, I'm really grateful that we as like in Switzerland are not part of the European Union, although it makes us our like job, because everything we ship abroad is exporting. So we do have like our own warehouse in Germany so that we can distribute more easily in whole Europe. But it's insane in what like strange direction the whole political European Union goes. I'm very happy that we never joined, because leaving is also quite painful, as you can see with the UK.
Yeah. Switzerland is a little island of more sovereignty, it seems, than the rest.
I think it's deep in our bloods, like with all the like the very strong privacy laws, like very high regard of like individual like liberty and like ownership rights and all that stuff. Because as a direct democracy, like if something like that comes up, like chat control or whatever, we can just veto it. And usually that's what happens. This is why we don't have a president. We only have a consortium of seven people that met, where basically every party is involved in the government and that somehow need to hash it out. And it's very conservative and usually not the most like innovative solution, but in the long run, it's kind of also like feels okay. There are like really hard limits what politics can do if the people don't like what it's doing.
I think, you know, and even using the word like conservative, you mean that in the true sense for any Americans listening that are associating that with some sort of particular political ideology. You mean conservative in the sense that we're going to be very careful with any changes that we make. We're going to be extremely careful, because as we've seen, many of the quote progressive policies that have been put forward around the world, and in America is no different. Well, they're not actually innovative or progressive. They're using that as a label to trick you into thinking that this is something that you need to support. Like, there's nothing progressive about censorship that is regressive, that is making Definitely. Us less free. And so it's,
yes.
it's nice to see. I once heard when I was in Lugano for the first Plan B forum. Mm-hmm. And I heard someone who's Swiss tell me, kind of joking, but also not, it was like, you know, Switzerland is the only first world country that's left in the world, basically saying that, like, even America, like, you guys are, you know, we can't consider you a first world country anymore. I was like, hey, you
okay.
know.
That's quite opinionated.
it is. I think he meant it also slightly jokingly, but I think it's okay.
I'm glad.
I do think that the direct democracy thing is so fascinating because it's like, really, I have to imagine your participation rates are fairly high when these things come about, or is it do you have any?
Not even. I think the fascinating thing is that boring stuff, many people don't even go to vote because they just trust that, like, the hive mind decides in their way anyway. And usually it actually is like that, because you can start like a public initiative, even could be very, like, very, well, it's a progressive or extreme, be it left or right or whatever. And that forces the government already to make a counter proposal. And when it comes to, like, saying yes or no to the initiative, they also put they very often say, if it's voted no, we'll still implement the counter proposal, basically as a, like, a fallback solution, so that the more extreme stuff is not like voted yes. So even if your initiative is not going through, you can still, like, build up a lot of pressure. And it's like, I don't know, it feels like we're not as divided as, or like politicized, like, in everyday life as other, like, countries, even in Europe. So I'm really glad we can still, like, hash stuff out and find compromises, even if it's tedious.
No pun intended on the hashing stuff out there. Well, Staticus, I want to be conscious of your time here, and I'm going to link for everyone some of the resources that you guys have. I'll also link bitbox.swiss/walker. So if folks want to get 5% off a Bitbox O2 or a nice seed, a metal seed backup, which is really nice. I got one of those that is, there's something nice about putting a seed in metal too. It's very satisfying. It can grab that. Is there anywhere else you want to send people? I'll link your socials as well, but anywhere else they should go, or you want to send people at all?
Sure. I think, like, bitbox.swiss is a very good starting place for everything we do. We do have a little bit unorganized. We're working on that, but a very in-depth blog. Maybe you can link a few of the
sure.
blog posts I've mentioned regarding AirGap, regarding Dark Skippy, stuff like that. We put a lot of effort into also, like, in our newsletter to, like, regularly publish in-depth article, just what we learn ourselves as well when we research new topics and then implement it. I think for more technically minded people, that can be, like, some interesting things there as well. And you mentioned you're from Wisconsin, right?
Yeah, originally from Wisconsin. Oh, wow. Where did you pull that cheese head from? Is it normal to wear cheese heads in Switzerland as well?
No, that's an original Green Bay Packers cheese
head. Wow. I was not expecting that. Okay.
I'm more going for the Jaguars, but Green Bay Packers is definitely my second team.
Amazing. Wow. That was what a lovely surprise. This is the first cheesehead appearance that has been made on this podcast. So thank you for that. last question, totally unrelated to everything. Are you reading anything right now that you'd recommend?
Good point. I just finished some things. I think what I really, really enjoyed reading lately was Educated by Tara something. I'm not sure. It's like a Mormon girl that, like, did her. It's an autobiography that worked her way out of, like, religious, cultish environment and went on to, like, law school and everything. And also read, just like Red the Client by John Grisham. So a bit more on the lighter side. Okay. Oldie but goldie. Stuff like that I always enjoy.
I appreciate it. I always just like to ask people what they're reading. I need to go through these and build up just a recommendation reading list for folks, because I've got a lot of them now. I'll find the time one of these days to go through it. But I appreciate that. Staticus, thank you so much for your time. This was a pleasure and incredibly informative. Appreciate your time very much.
Thanks a lot, Walker.
And that's a wrap on this Bitcoin Talk episode of the Bitcoin Podcast. If you are a Bitcoin-only company interested in sponsoring another fucking Bitcoin podcast, head to bitcoinpodcast.net/sponsor. If you're enjoying the Bitcoin Podcast, consider giving the show a 5-star review wherever you listen, or sharing the show with your friends, family, and strangers on the internet. Or don't, Bitcoin doesn't care, but I always appreciate it. You can find me on Nostr by going to primal.net/walker. If you want to follow The Bitcoin Podcast on Twitter, go to @TitcoinPodcast and @WalkerAmerica. You can also find the video version of this podcast at youtube.com/@WalkerAmerica and @WalkerAmerica on Rumble. Or just go to bitcoinpodcast.net/podcast and find links everywhere. Bitcoin is scarce. There will only ever be 21 million, but Bitcoin podcasts are abundant. So thank you for spending your scarce time to listen to another fucking Bitcoin podcast. Until next time, stay free.